And good morning, and welcome to Word of Mouth, the program where captivating people talk about their unique jobs. I'm your host, Jim Wunderlich, and today I'll be chatting with career journalist Mike Conklin. Mike was a writer at the Chicago Tribune for 35 years, spending at most of it as a daily columnist in sports and then news, as well as feature writer and beat reporter. Mike also worked on small Midwestern dailies and for radio and TV stations. He left the Tribune in 2005 to join the DePaul University faculty, and he has a master's degree in Chicago Studies from Loyola. His freelance writing has been seen in a variety of publications, ranging from the New York Times and History Magazine to Basketball Weekly and Soccer America. And Mike, thanks so much for being here. Apologize for the drive, but thank you very, very much for being here.
No. Actually, it's not all that far away, so it's just a lot of construction.
Oh, I tell you, though, really appreciate it. So much to talk about, and I'm just thinking, my gosh, what haven't you covered? So many subjects, so many events, from Final Fours to U.S. Opens, golf and tennis, presidential elections. I really don't know where to begin, but I tell you what, I want to just back up, like I said. What attracted you to a career in journalism, and what triggered your interest?
Well, I was a failed athlete in high school, and the way I could wrangle a deal to continue going to the games and being a part of the whole thing was to write about them for the local newspaper. And my father was helpful, knew the publisher. We're talking a small weekly in Iowa, and so I started covering high school sports while I was a high school student, and actually got paid for it, which, you know, to me is like, wow, you can actually tell stories and make money. And it just sort of morphed from there. And then the next thing I knew, before I was out of high school, I was covering city council meetings and school board meetings. And I thought that was pretty cool because, you know, I'm actually covering, you know, the people that were in charge of my town, you know, and I had the final word on it.
Now, this is a weekly newspaper?
Yeah.
We're in Iowa.
It was near Cedar Rapids, a town called Mount Vernon, Iowa.
Oh, sure,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah,
Cornell
yeah.
University is there.
Yeah, Cornell College.
Or Cornell College,
which is older than Cornell University, I might add, because that's my alma mater. So
right,
I was
right,
a hometown
right.
guy. I went to school there, too,
right.
at the same time. So.
So in college, did you continue to write then, I assume?
Yeah, you know, I worked on school papers, and I was the editor of the school paper in college. And I never had the benefit of a large high school that had a school paper or anything like that. I mean, I just started doing it for the local paper for money. And then when I was in college, we didn't have a journalism department, but the next best thing was to, you know, work on the school paper and sort of on-the-job self-training, I guess. And I did that, and then I actually left school for several years. I decided I didn't think school was for me, and I went out and got a job on a newspaper. And I spent, I spent maybe two and a half years working on small dailies around the Midwest, and then decided finally that I wanted to go back to college and finish. So I went back and then graduated, and then left after that for the Chicago Tribune.
You went right from college to the Tribune, but actually you had worked at Midwestern dailies for a while.
Right, and I
so
also
So that's worked, a big deal.
Well, yeah, and I mean, they weren't very big papers, but they were...
But it's a daily.
Yeah, it was dailies. It was great training, and I worked
Where'd
on,
you work? I'm just curious.
Yeah, well, I worked... The first job I had was a newspaper in Webster City, Iowa, just north of Des Moines. And
they have a daily.
Yeah. And well, they still maybe do, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But And I worked there, and then... I worked there for about 9 months, and I had heard about this place that was hiring that seemed like a step up, Belvidere, Illinois, near Rockford.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
And so I left there after 9 months, and then I worked almost 2 years in Belvidere, and then when I went back to school, I only had to go part time to finish because I had accumulated enough hours. So, but I had these sort of obligations I had to take, you know, Spanish 2 and all that kind of stuff.
Sure, sure.
And so, when I was in college, my last year, I got a job working for a TV radio station in Cedar Rapids, KCRG. It was an
sure.
ABC affiliate.
Yeah.
And so I went to school, and I worked there full-time at the same time. And
Unbelievable story.
Well, what? Yeah.
This is called paying your dues,
well,
folks.
Well, paying your dues.
While you're doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, while you're going to school, you're paying your dues.
Yeah. Well, and tuition, but no.
Yeah.
And I, so... in my last year of college, I worked that year full-time at a TV and radio station, and all my classes were in the morning. I arranged it that way, and then I would go up in the afternoon and do beat reporting, and we'd run all over the eastern Iowa, you know, shooting, you know, I would be the interviewer, you know, on TV and
sure.
With a cameraman, you know, the floods of Dubuque every year, where it's, you know, or, you know, the local murder or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. we would be there shooting that stuff. And then I would deliver the news at night on radio. I was the anchor guy on radio. So I'd come back and I'd go to the police station and the courthouse and all that kind of stuff and run around. And then I had to write my own newscast for like, I guess it was the 10 o'clock news on radio at the time. I was like the anchor guy. But my TV stuff was, you know, on another. The TV and radio station were owned by the same people. So
you're at the ripe old age of what, 22 or 24, 25?
Yeah, 23, 24.
When you have all of this experience, radio, TV, news, and working on dailies.
Well, it even gets better because this was the late 60s, and this was a time when campuses were, you know, quite in states of, you know, tumultuousness because of the anti-war movement. Mm-hmm. So I ended up writing a lot of stuff for other newspapers covering stuff at the University of Iowa, which wasn't very far away. And, you know, I'd go and I'd do stuff for TV, and then I'd rewrite my stories for the newspaper and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was great training.
Any story you remember back in those days? Any vivid memories or a story or two?
Yeah, sure, for sure. I was in Belvedere when the tornado hit in 1967.
Oh, yeah.
I was a block away from it. It hit the school and killed 24 people, and I just left the school, and the buses were parked out in front with the kids waiting for the older kids to get on, and I can vividly remember looking in my rearview mirror and boy, that weather really looked weird, you know, and I go like two blocks away and the tornado hit that parking lot.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was actually years and years later, Storm Stories did a documentary on this and that Weather Channel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was, you know, they call me and we hear you worked on the paper there and all that stuff. And so they did, you know, they did a documentary. But that clearly that was like a seminal thing for me early because everything else I'd done up until then was, you know, not quite of that magnitude. 24 people get killed. And I remember our little newsroom in Belvedere became kind of a media central. Well, newspapers and TV stations were coming from around the Midwest. And I remember bumping up against all these reporters. And I thought that was pretty cool at the time. And, you know, being kind of in the middle of the storm.
Right. I mean, it was all happening at that time.
Yeah.
Excitement, the energy.
Yeah, absolutely.
It happens, unfortunately, with a tragedy of that magnitude.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. But everybody's got to roll their sleeves up and get the news.
Forget sleep and forget, you know, what you had to do that night and everything. In fact, that night I was supposed to go do something. And that's why I was at the school double checking with some coaches on where we were going to meet and everything, and then ba-boom.
And there you were, just two blocks away, and there it happens.
Boy,
that's unbelievable.
So that was a big thing. And then then you do, like when you work on small dailies, you have to be a jack of all trades. And, you know, I was both the sports editor and I was the city hall guy. And, you know, you'd go to cover courts and you'd cover, you know, crimes and then boring meetings and then go to the high school baseball game, that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, so.
Sounds a lot like, you know, Roger Ebert, I read his book, and it mm-hmm. sounds very similar with a lot of the people who have gone to the Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have a question. The jump you made to the Tribune, it's obvious that you had a portfolio at a very young age, but how does that occur? How does that happen? Because that's a big deal, Mike.
It is.
I know you were there for 35 years, but I want to tell you, that's a big deal.
Well, the thing is, you have to kind of go back in history a little bit, but in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, the Tribune was really trying to remake its image because it had been this, you know, Colonel McCormick and it had been this right-wing mm-hmm. rag that just, you know, beat on everybody. And
American flag on the masthead.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And in the late 60s, after the Colonel was gone, they went through this 3 or 4 year period where they really wanted to remake the image, and the way to do it, and they were spending money in those days because they were making money, but the way to do it was to hire a whole wave of young people. And I just happened to be there at the right place at the right time. And in fact, I remember they flew a bunch of us in one weekend, and I had interviewed with a city editor who had come to Iowa. I wrote him a letter, and they said, well, we're going to have an interview at Iowa City at the University of Iowa at the journalism school if we'll schedule in for a certain time because you're not that far away. Now, this was in my last year of college, and that's good, you know. So I go down, and I interview with the city editor, and we hit it off because I had this, like you say, portfolio of stories, and he loved all that stuff. And then the next thing I know, I get an invite to fly in, I think it was like February or March or something, and they wanted to interview me further with the editors, and the top guys and all that. And then I get in and I find out there's like dozens of people. They're flying in from all over the country. I mean, this was like their big recruiting week, you know.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Okay, there was just a complete new vanguard of people
Absolutely.
Coming in.
Yeah, triggered by a guy by the name of Clayton Kirkpatrick.
Oh, sure.
I'm rooming with guys from Northwestern and Columbia University in New York, and and I'm thinking, oh man, you know, Cornell College, I don't know, this is going to play. it was a funny story because I'm going through the reception line, and Clayton Kirkpatrick is introducing himself to everybody, and we're all, you know, shaking his hand, and he's asking everybody where they went to school, you know, and I'm thinking, oh man, I'm sunk. I mean, because you know, little four-year liberal arts college like Carroll or
right,
this is never going to fly.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I'll do the thing we always do, and not always, but some of us have done. He said, you know, and where did you go to school, Mike? I said, well, Cornell. You know, I just left it at that. I let him draw his own conclusion.
Ivy League.
Yeah, whatever. Right. Yeah. And but then he looked me square in the eye and he said, which Cornell? And I said, well, Cornell College in Iowa. And he looked at me and he says, great school. My daughter graduated from there.
Oh, that's a great story.
But
you had the portfolio.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, there were guys, you know, guys were turning down the job. I mean, you know, because they had better offers among the people that they had recruited to come in. So,
jeez.
You know, so I know. And I tell that, when I would tell that to my students at DePaul, you know, they look at me like, oh, man, I was in the wrong
Washington Post, New York Times. I'm running out of fingers now. So
that's
pretty amazing.
So, you know, I was, you know, that's kind of the way it worked. Right place, right time, that sort of stuff.
Well, but also you were getting experience way before you even went to college.
Yeah.
So you were paying some dues there.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in many people shouldn't go to college for 4 years after they get out of college. I've always felt that.
Or after you get out of high school.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And I think that's been substantiated even more having taught in college and teaching courses for freshmen and sophomores. In many cases, they don't know why they're there, and I don't know why they're there. And they would benefit much more by taking a year off and going out and do something, I think, you know, and then getting a little more direction.
There's definitely something to that.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. Getting your feet wet,
sure.
Really. Now, the first week I do want to talk about,
sure.
You're at the Chicago Tribune, and I know you're kind of a seasoned reporter here, I guess, of sorts, but it's still the Chicago Tribune,
sure,
and now
sure.
You're rubbing shoulders with, I don't know if Mike Royko had come up, had he come over from the Daily News yet?
No, he actually worked at City News Bureau first, and then he was at the Daily News. That came quite a bit later. What we did have was...
Gene Siskel, some of those guys?
Yeah, Siskel and I were there at the same time.
Okay.
Mike Sneed was there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, there
Bill
were
whole, Jouse?
Jouse worked at The American when I first got there.
Oh, Chicago American.
Yeah, and then it became Today, Chicago Today. But what happens is the Tribune would take all of us,
mm-hmm.
and they would throw us into this one big newsroom called Neighborhood News, and we all were assigned certain suburbs to go cover, and then that was our thing.
Mm.
And we had to write a certain number of stories each week, and then our section was sort of zoned into the paper, and twice a week our section would, you know, like I had the Northwest suburbs, and so like I would cover Park Ridge and Arlington Heights and
mm-hmm.
Palatine, and actually Rolling Meadows, I'm not even sure if Rolling Meadows was a city then, or, you know, incorporated.
Sure.
But, and then we would cover, you know, all those things that were related to it, and we'd bounce them off an editor, of course, first, and then we would produce so many stories per week that would be slotted in to the section. It's like working for like a bi-weekly sort of, you know, is what it was. But,
you know what, though? You're known for
semi-weekly.
Your byline is, I guess, would be sports reporter for the most part, though you have done all sorts of things, History Magazine and that type of thing. When did you move into sports, or what do you recall your first sports event doing? Were you already covering sports at the high school level, that type of thing?
No. What happened was when you were working in Neighborhood News, you would, everyone spent at least 6 to 9 months there, but you would be targeted for a particular section to go to, and then they basically would say, like, well, what's your interest, you know? I mean, where would you like to be, not here? Because this was like their training ground. And, you know, like some guy, well, I'd like to write features, or I'd like to write entertainment, or I'd like to write this or that. Well, then when an opening popped up in one of those sections, you know, they'd come in and they'd move you up, you know? And I wanted to get out of Neighborhood News. And I said, well, sports, even though I had this kind of dual background. And so when an opening came up in sports, you know, I went in and, you know, and re-interviewed with the sports editor. And he said, sure, come on in. We'll move you over here then. So, you know, but...
And then you started doing these amazing sporting events, as I mentioned in the intro.
Well, not so fast there.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm gonna jet ahead a little
sure,
bit.
Sure.
Okay, but I'm fascinated by the Olympics to start off with, among the sporting events.
Winter Olympics.
You covered two Winter Olympics.
Albertville and Lillehammer.
Okay. That had to have been an exciting time for you when you were reporting that. Mm-hmm. You're furrowing your brow, though, like it wasn't so exciting.
Well, it's traveling abroad.
Okay.
It's passports. Mm-hmm. It's shots. It's going to...
It is shots. Okay.
Well, whatever, in okay. those days. It's okay. going to a place that you've never been to before.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, maybe a small percent, you know, not a huge number of people speak your language. It's dealing with press credentials. It's dealing with all, it's how do I get my story back to the United States? I mean, there's a whole bunch of technical stuff that comes with that too at the same time. So, and sometimes just getting to the event and watching it and writing about it is really the tip of the iceberg in many cases.
That's the tip of the iceberg.
Right, right.
How did you get the stories back in those days?
Well, in those days, gee, what did we do? We had telecopiers. And what did we do? Gosh, I can't even remember now. We traveled, and to be honest with you, I didn't have that much to do with it because we traveled with a whole desk of people that went over. I was part of each time I went, I was part of a team,
mm-hmm.
including editors, people who edited our copy. Most people don't understand. You don't write a story and it goes into print. I mean, it goes through two or three people, before it even reaches print. I mean, we brought over like a copy desk, in effect. I would turn my stories into the copy desk over there. We had like this traveling, sometimes I would call them and dictate,
mm-hmm.
This is totally before new media.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it wasn't like you could text and do any of that sort
right,
of stuff,
right.
you know. And we had laptops, and we sent them to a central bank. A data bank that was set up especially for us, you'd type your story in a computer and you'd send it to that. Then the copy editors, everybody thinks when you say editors, you're talking about your bosses, not necessarily, you're talking about people who edit your copy, would take, they would pull the stories out of the bank and do their little thing and add the right thing, make sure everything is spelled right and all that kind of stuff. I mean, and then, and maybe move some things around a little bit and maybe they'd trim a little off your story or maybe they'd call you back and say, we could really use maybe another 300 words or something like that because that's the hole it's got to fit.
Now, that's part of the newspaper business.
Yeah.
But did that ever, were there ever problems there, personalities?
Sure.
I was going to say, let's say I've written this terrific lead.
Mm-hmm.
And then the editor just starts to come up with something
sure.
else.
Sure, it's a war. It's a war.
It is a war.
It is a war.
Okay,
it's absolute war. And that's one of the things when I taught courses in journalism, most people don't understand. I mean, you're not golden. You know, you're not the center of the universe. What you say is not necessarily the greatest amount of wisdom, even though you've been there, because many people have been there before you too. At the same time, and that doesn't mean you can write just because you see and you process. You know, you still have to put it in a compelling way. You know, and a copy editor might say like, well, gee, I think this fifth paragraph down here is a lot more important than what you put at the lead. You know, I think we ought to move that up there and work it that way. You know, instead, you know. And for the most part, you know, there'll be some battles go on if you mm-hmm. really were in love with something you had written.
Mm-hmm.
But the worst thing you can do is fall in love with your words because the editors for sure will throw water all over them in many cases. Or maybe not. It depends on the editor, mm-hmm. you know, too. So it's like a war, you know, and a battle. And I've known, I mean, you'd be surprised at the number of people, and I won't go out of school, but who we recognize as great writers, they weren't.
They weren't great writers.
They were good storytellers, but they weren't good writers. And, and the copy desk actually made them look good in many cases. So
interesting.
Yeah. In fact, when I started in sports, you know, the first 3 years, I was a copy editor. I mean, you don't go out and just cover stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you had to pay your dues and you had to learn, and you learn better, too. You learn, you know, how to write better by editing other people's copy.
Mm-hmm. Back to the Olympics.
Sure.
What did you cover in those Winter Olympics? Or what do you remember in terms of a story that was compelling, to use your word?
Let's see now. I guess, well, the second Olympics I went to in Lillehammer, that was the great Tanya Harding.
Oh, my gosh. Olympics. You were there for that.
Yeah, yeah. And I was there for that. I didn't cover the actual figure. See, when you come and you cover something like the Winter Olympics, first of all, you're there for about a month. And there's these events, venues all over. I mean, they're not just in one central location. You know, you might be covering something that's 60 miles away up in the mountains or something, you know. And so you got to get there, you know, in an area where access is really restricted to, you know, authorized vehicles and such.
Gee, I thought you Tribune guys had limos.
No. Well, you know, then there's the New York Times guys or the LA Times guys or the Washington Post guys. There's the
New Yorker.
The London Times. I mean, and there's all the foreign stuff, too.
Yeah.
And so Anyway, so you know, so you're part of this little big team that's over there.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I didn't cover figure skating, I was at some of the press conferences. Like, they might send me out to go to a press conference and bring back some quotes for another guy's story, for instance.
Okay.
Or write a sidebar. I mean, like, when you go, nobody writes the story. One person does, but there are many other stories that, you know, that you have to cover. When I was there the first time in France, I was covering downhill skiing, you know. I was the downhill skiing guy.
Jeez.
And
that has to take a lot of prep before you go over there, right?
Yeah, it does, because I had never covered it before in my life.
And do you downhill ski at all? Or?
No.
Yeah, so now here you are. You're going to cover this Olympic
event. What difference does that make?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like I always tell people, you don't have to get hit by a car to know that it hurts. You know, I mean, you know, you can still write about it, you know. So
Right.
And then the irony of it was is that I had a background as a hockey writer. And I spent a couple of years covering the Blackhawks. But I didn't cover hockey. And they put me on skiing, and they put the guy from the Orlando. See, the Tribune would send people from their network of newspapers over there to cover
this stuff.
And there'd be guys there from Orlando. This was before we owned the LA Times, but there'd be guys there from other newspapers that we owned. And then we would all go over as a team. And then that first time I basically was the downhill skiing guy and moguls and all this kind of stuff. And then I did a bunch of other things too. I might have even covered curling. I'm not sure.
Oh my gosh. Which has now become very popular.
Because
they've got the hottest athletes.
Sure.
Yeah.
So
Sports Illustrated had that they had the hottest athletes in the curling. Well, I don't know if you saw
could
that.
Could be.
Yeah,
could
yeah.
Be. You could prove it by me. And then I was at Lillehammer, and I did some stuff off the Tonya Harding, but Phil Hirsch was our real go-to guy for all that. He wrote the lead stories almost every day. Unless something really marvelous happened at the event you were at, like say the U.S. pulled a huge upset in some sport or some activity that, you know, was not given a lot of notice ahead of time, then they might say, well, let's move that up, and we'll put that on page one, and the other stuff will go inside then or something like that.
Okay, moving away from the Olympics, the Bears you covered, too, playoffs.
That's team stuff, too, though. I mean, I was never a Bears beat guy. But
right.
But, I mean, when the Bears play, and now more than when I was in sports, you know, we'd send maybe four or five guys to a Bear game. You know, there'd be a couple guys writing about the Bears, about what happened in the game. There might be a guy writing about the star. There might be a guy writing about the goat, you know. Generally, I had the visitor's locker room. And which they never do now. I don't understand that. But I used
You're
to
right
go,
about that. They don't.
I go into the visitors' locker room a lot, and you know, I used to be the guy that go over there, and maybe I'd pick some stuff out that would help someone else, and someone else would pick something out that would help me, and you'd trade out a little bit with your own guys, and then I would, you know, in many cases, I would write a sidebar, what we'd call a sidebar, in the opponent's locker room, you know.
What might be an example of a sidebar you might have done?
Oh, say for instance, an opposing player had done something really positive that helped their team beat the Bears, for instance, you know. Well, we're still going to have a Bears angle on everything, you know. And then I might go over and talk to that guy and the coach about what kind of an impact it was, and then maybe I might learn more about that guy. That maybe this isn't the first time he's done it, or maybe this was like a tremendous accomplishment for him because he'd gone through all this personal turmoil just to be in this game at this time in his life, for instance, you know. And then I would look for some angle that would, you know, kind of accent what he had done on the field, and then maybe I would take some of the stuff and give it to the lead guy who would incorporate it into the main story.
Okay.
And then I would do like the secondary story on maybe an individual from the other team, for instance, or maybe an assistant coach or something like that.
Very collaborative.
Oh, yeah.
Ditka, before we break, your impressions of Coach Ditka? Bigger than life?
Yeah, kind of an underachiever as a coach, though, because I think they could have won more championships in the years that he was there. And, you know, he's living off his image like most of these guys do. I mean, he's, you know, he was the king of endorsements, you know, very successful, you know, coach, self-made guy, all that kind of stuff, you know. But, you know, he never met an endorsement he didn't like to make, you know, didn't like to pick up a few extra bucks for, you know. But
good soundbite, though.
Oh, yeah.
The coach.
Yeah, he's very good at that stuff.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
In fact, his nickname used to be One Take Ditka because they'd go to shoot these ads and they never usually needed to do more than one take because he was so good at it. I think he probably could have been an actor if he wasn't so famous in other areas, you know, like Dick Butkus or something.
Right,
like
exactly. Yeah. My gosh, this has been a lot of fun, Mike. We are talking to Mike Conklin, and we're talking about his 35-year career with the Chicago Tribune, and among other things. When we come back, we're going to talk about maybe a few more sporting events, but also Mike's involvement in covering presidential elections, the White House, City Hall. Don't go away. And that's Tom Petty, Running Down a Dream. And if you're just joining us, my name is Jim Wunderlich. You're listening to Word of Mouth on WRLR. And we are fortunate to have Mike Conklin with us, who has been running down stories his whole life as a career journalist, 35 years with the Chicago Tribune. And we were talking about the Olympics and the Chicago Bears, and you've done so many amazing sporting events. And we may get back to some of those. But I'd kind of like to move to politics, which is kind of interesting because I didn't know that you had covered so much of that. And because your byline, like I said in the first segment, I think of Mike Conklin as sports, but you've just really written so many different things as we'll explore. But you also covered, like I said, political conventions, presidential elections, and White House dinners. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about the White House dinner. I don't mean to be glib, mm-hmm. but there's more to it than the appetizer, I take it.
Yeah. It's condition that and say that they were White House correspondence dinners I used to go to.
Okay.
And but the presidents were always there and all that kind of stuff. And you know, and it was.
But you were in the White House.
No.
Oh.
The White House correspondence dinners were always in the Hilton where Reagan got it.
Okay.
Not too far away.
Okay.
And and then, you know, I covered events where the president was there, that kind of stuff. But you know, it's what would I want to say? I was always part of a big group. What I would do a lot when I was a columnist for 5 years in news, and it was a people column. It was a bit of a gossip column. It was a bit of a
Ink column?
Yeah,
you were
the
doing?
Ink column. Right.
That's very famous.
Yeah.
Aaron Gold.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Sure.
Michael Snead and
sure.
all. Yeah. Yeah.
yeah.
And celebrity
Kathy
stuff.
O'Malley. I replaced Kathy O'Malley.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, but
I recall that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. And then,
at the time, I got to tell you now, when you went to that, I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting jump, but not really.
Because I was only the second male to ever be on that column.
Next to Aaron Gold.
Yeah. Right. And it was, and I actually lobbied for it because I was getting kind of bored with sports, to be perfectly honest with you. But I thought, well, what's the difference, you know? And there's a big mix anyway between sports and entertainment and politics. I mean, you know, they're all to cover it. It's basically the same thing. And I mean, you apply, if you're a professional, you apply the same principles no matter what. You know, you go to the people behind the scenes, you set up your access. It's all about access. It's all about, you know, getting access to people. That's what separates you from the guy on the street. And so
you're saying there's more similarities between politics and sports than there are differences.
I'll tell you a perfect example.
Sure.
When I was covering, when I was on the Inc. column, I'd been doing it for a couple of years, and I'd interviewed a few people, you know, in politics, and you do everything, City Hall, all this kind of stuff. And I had, when the Cubs opened up their season one year, they were going to, Hillary Clinton was going to toss out the first pitch. Now, this is when she was first lady. And the early 90s or something, you know, I thought, well, you know, maybe I can get some time with her, you know, because you're the Tribune. It's not me. You're the Tribune. I mean, people want to talk to you because you represent a million readers. You did in those days anyway. So it's not like me, but it's the Tribune wants to talk to you. Oh, you know, whatever. So that's good exposure for people. So I called up the press secretary. I mean, you know, you're only ever just two phone calls away from these people. Hmm. And I called up the press secretary and I said, so Hillary's going to be tossing out the first, yeah, we're coming in flying from Houston or something. Lisa Caputo was the press secretary. Mm-hmm. She said, we're flying in from Houston, da, 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 da. I said, how about if I get a little time with her, can I just get her for like two or three questions or something? And I'll, you know, the usual, you know, do two paragraphs in the Ink column and here's Hillary and lifelong Cub fan or whatever. Who knows? I mean, you know, but, you know, I'm not looking for, you know, Pulitzer here or whatever. And so Lisa said, well, I'll see if I can work something out for you, you know, because we don't know the schedule. We're on the fly with this thing, whatever, da, 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 da. But, you know, it's the Tribune calling. It's not like it's, you know, Joe Schmo or something that just wants to meet her or something. So even though I may be Joe Schmo, but so I get a call like a day before, well, it's looking a little tight. We don't know. She says, you know, I'll tell you what, though. If you want to give me the questions, I promise you I will get you back the answers, you know, that will be candid and will be her answers. You know, I said, well, you know, no, no, that's not quite the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know, you know. And, you know, as a journalist all these years, you develop pretty good layer of skepticism and cynicism and whatever. So I said, well, okay, here's a couple questions, but, you know, I'm not in love with this, and I can't promise you I'll use it, you know, we'll see what we can do. So I'm at the game, and I'm, you know, she tosses out the first pitch, and I'm in the press box, and I get a call from Lisa. She says, hey, we've got some time. She said, how would you like to give Hillary a tour of the press box in the second or third inning or something like that, because she's going to come up and do a WGN thing. No, she wasn't going to do a WGN thing, because they usually don't have people like that.
Mm-hmm.
She says, and you could just show her around the press box, then you can answer all the questions you want. I said, sure, okay. She said, all right, we'll be up there at the top of the third inning, you know, at the elevator or whatever, da-da-da. No, top of the third, she calls me. I go back, there's Hillary. I meet her, you know, and her entourage and the whole bit, you know. So I for a half an inning, I show her around the press, and here's where the, you know, the print guys are, and, you know, here's the broadcast guys doing their thing, and then here's where the PR guys, and they're all their tat. And she's asking me all kinds of questions about it. She wants to know, you know, how it
mm-hmm.
works. And all
sure,
that.
Sure.
And so that's it. You know, at the end of the half inning, she leaves. I'm, you know, I got more than a notebook full of stuff and everything, and she's gone. You know, so, I mean, it's like this. I guess my point is that politics, sports, they cross the borders all the time. You know, so I was
It's accessibility that's the key, sounds like here.
Absolutely. If you don't have access, you don't have anything. You're just another guy on the street. That's what always, you know, kind of gets me upset sometimes when I see a lot of stuff now. They're not talking to anybody. They're talking to each other. And
yeah.
And it's all opinion. It's all speculation.
Sports talk, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You what people don't understand is the real role of a journalist is to be a middleman. You are a middleman. Mm-hmm. You are the middleman between the audience, and one of the things you always have to know who your audience is, and the source. You know, you are the middle person, and that whole thing. You're not bigger than either one of those things. And that's what I've always taught my students over the years. You know, and then after a while, you get that way whether you want to be or not. Because, like, when you start out, look at me. I'm in a Cubs locker room, or I'm in the Bears. I must be important. No, you're not important. You know, you're just the middle guy between. You're conveying the impressions, the facts, the sights, the sounds, the smells to the audience. That's all you're doing. It's a conveyor belt, you know, if you're doing it right. And then after a while, you develop a very professional outlook about this, and you don't get too excited, and you don't get too down, and you just go about gathering in a workmanlike way, you know, the facts, the impressions that will build a good story that you think will be representative of what you just saw or were assigned. It's as simple as that.
Now, you were the middleman for basically City Hall and Mayor Daley at one point, too. Weren't you covering local politics,
I would go out and do stuff. I did, when I was doing the ink column, you know, I'd have people call me. You got to understand, like, when you're doing the ink column, it's like Snead or something. I'd get 50 calls a day from people, you know, and I had a secretary.
Because they want their little bold-faced name in there.
Right, right. And, you know, everybody's selling something, you know, it's as simple as that. And everybody comes to Chicago. That's my other thing. Everybody comes to Chicago, one way or another, if they're peddling a book or this or that or whatever. So it's a trade-out game. Well, if I think that person is important enough that I want to write about them, or they've got a story to tell that I want to tell that hasn't been told, you know, okay, I'll give you yours, but you got to give me mine. You know, like, for instance, a restaurant calls. I used to get this all the time. Oh, we had such and such in here eating today. You know, and my response was, well, so what? They got to eat somewhere, you know. I mean, and then I always...
always funny, isn't it?
And my standard response always, well, did they choke on a bone? You know, I got to ask something more than just they were there. You either have to eavesdrop in some way, give me something. You know, you have to. There's got to be something other than that person was just there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if they did, I said, okay, then I'll see if I can. I might be able to work something up on this. You know, so.
So let's talk about the keys to writing. Mm-hmm. And you just said choke on a bone.
Yeah.
So the old standard thing used to be that if you're a reporter. If dog bites man,
sure.
You know where I'm going there.
Yeah, yeah, and okay. All the news values.
Yeah, yeah. Man bites dog. Sure, now you got a story. Of course, man bites man. The World Cup.
Yeah.
So, what are the keys when you tell people, geez, or you're telling students, or after all your years, to writing a riveting, compelling story? Granted, the facts, the five W's: who, what, when, where, why.
Mm-hmm.
But what else are you looking for?
I always say it's all about telling people something they don't know. It's all about, I always tell them, it's coming up with something exclusive. It's coming up with something that nobody else has. It's coming up with something that's breaking. It's got some news value to it. Or it's a spinoff on something that I always tell. This is what I always used to tell my students, and they have a hard time with this sometimes. But I've been to, you know, the big events where I've been part of the packs, you know, of journalists that are surrounding with their microphones and, you know, get on stuff. You know, it's really pretty boring. You're not going to really get anything in those circumstances that isn't being told by someone else. I always tell my students, I'd rather, and I know this will sound like a big cliche, but I'd rather tell one of the 10,000 stories that's never been told than be part of the 10,000 reporters reporting the same story.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
And no, I guess.
You know, yeah. I mean, I'd much rather be telling somebody, and maybe the most fun, all this stuff we're talking about here, when I was at the Tribune, I was a Tempo writer. The last 5 or 6 years I was there, I wrote feature stories for the Tempo section. And it'd be like the style section of the Washington Post, or the feature, the national page, perhaps, of the New York Times. But I would get assignments.
I love the Tempo section, by the way.
Oh, I loved it.
I would turn to it right away.
I had more fun.
There's always something more unique there.
And a little deeper.
Yes.
A little deeper. And
yeah.
And not as cyclic.
Right.
In other words, like sports is all cycles. It's just as simple as that. You know, they're bad, they're good, then they're bad again, then they're good again. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all a big cycle. And but I would have assignments where, like, they'd say, okay, take 3 days. I'd pitch a story to them. For instance, I'll give you an example. Like, abandon opera houses. Okay.
Hmm.
Now, I'll say that to you, and you, but like the Woodstock Opera House right now is a big deal. There's a few little opera houses in downstate Illinois that have really been made into like little local community Taj Mahals where they do all kinds of cultural things or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I said, and I remember once I went to one of my editors and I said, you know, I think there'd be a story in old abandoned houses, like old one-room schoolhouses that are all over downstate Illinois, because I'm hearing more and more about things like that. And they go, well, okay, all right, so take a week, you know, and drive around downstate and just look for them, you know, gather them up and take some pictures and write a story about it. You know, I love doing stuff like that. I wrote a story once where I learned that there was a town in downstate Illinois that had a cemetery, and one side of it was where the Democrats were buried, and one side of it was where the Republicans were buried.
No kidding.
Now this was from the Civil War is where it started.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, of course, that wasn't the case.
Mm-hmm.
But there still were sections where the Democrats were buried and the Republicans were buried. Now, I mean, we think like right now, oh, never seen it worse, you know, the Democrats, Republicans, everybody. No. Come on. Civil War, for God's sake. I mean, there's all kinds of examples in history of how things were worse than they are right now as far as polarization and politics and everything. And I love to write stories that pointed out those kinds of things. And so I went down, I did a story, and, you know, and I had some old historian that I got a hold of or something, and he told me, oh, yeah, you know, 1840, they had a shootout with these Democrats here. And so from that point on, everybody in this family's over there and that family's over there.
Crazy.
Well, but then that changed. So while I'm down there, I hear about, and I'm talking to a guy that's kind of an expert. He works for the state comptroller's office because the state comptroller controls all the cemeteries and the budgets for all the public cemeteries in Illinois. He says, "Oh, you want a real story? You ought to go find Cemetery Girl. There's a girl over there in some other town. She actually goes out and learns everything she can about everybody in these cemeteries." Oh man, that's a little goofy. And so I called the family though. I got a hold of the name. I thought, you know, just you follow up. You're like a detective. And it turns out when she was in junior high, a teacher had told the students to write something about something that wouldn't be here 50 years from now. So her dad says, "Well, you know, I know there's this abandoned cemetery." He said, "We ought to go over there and write about that, you know, because it probably won't be here in 50 years." And there's hundreds of abandoned cemeteries in the state of Illinois. Now, you know, I say that, and a lot of people might start yawning, you know.
No.
But I find stuff like that really interesting. Mm-hmm. And so I got a hold of her, and she said, "Yeah." She said, "When I was in eighth grade, he took me to the cemetery. We had to climb over some fences and all this, and I wrote a story about it. And I really fell in love with this idea of these people." So she started tracking down the names of all the people in this abandoned cemetery. She started keeping it up herself. She'd take lawnmowers over there. Her dad would take her over there, and she started keeping. And she found out who the veterans were, and she would put flags out there. And this girl was like in high school, you know, and she was doing all that kind of stuff. And so she started to become an expert on cemeteries in this county. You know,
people
would come to her, and she was in high school. I mean, how many times do you find a kid like that? You know, so I loved writing stories like that.
That's kind of like the Harry Porterfield Someone you should know.
Well, or Charles Carroll.
Charles Carroll on the road, yes.
Yeah, yeah, I love doing that stuff. And I think that a lot of that stuff gets ignored. You know, it doesn't get exposure like it should. People that are, to me, are like true heroes, really. Sports guys aren't heroes. They've been pampered all their lives, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what I like. I like finding stuff. And that girl went on to become like a history teacher, and I still stay in touch with her a little bit and stuff, you know.
Do we not see as many stories? We see more about the sexy players and that type of thing, as you're saying, and that's the word I'm using. News needs to be sensationalized or sexy for people to generate interest, for people to read it. I mean, the story about the cemetery girl, which is Carl, that, I find that fascinating, but maybe many people would rather read about the World Cup guy biting somebody's shoulder.
And there's no shortage of people to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a shortage of people, I think, that want to go out and tell the other stories that are out there, too, that never get told. I think that, when I teach it to Paul and all the students, oh, yeah, I want to cover the big event. I want to be in Chicago. I want to be in the big city, all that kind of stuff. You know, I tell them, you know, I mean, like, I think maybe where it first really dawned on me, you don't have to be in the big city to be a part of the big story, was the tornado in Belvedere. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff happening out there, and it's really interesting, I think. And I think in the long run, if you can find a market for that sort of stuff, you know, to me, that's just more fascinating.
Well, as we're talking about reporting and being a journalist, what are some of the biggest challenges or obstacles that you found or that you know of reporters finding in being a reporter or journalist?
Well, I mean, you know, your
accessibility. We talked a little about that.
People that don't talk.
Oh, yeah.
You know, people that don't talk, you know.
Like Popovich, for example.
Yeah, whatever, you know. And there's usually a reason, you know. And to be honest, in some cases, I don't blame them because, you know, every time you come after a game, you got people asking you silly questions, you know, which are silly questions in many cases. And what people don't understand is you'll get – how many times when you watch a TV interview of an athlete or a coach after a game that they also show the reporter? They almost always do that, you know, asking the questions. Well, do you think that's the first time that, you know, every reporter might be asking that same question, but they keep asking and asking and asking again so they can have their guy shown asking the questions and somehow make him seem like, or she seem like they're more important, you know. So sometimes these sort of groups, you know, where there's 10,000 reporters all reporting.
Groups?
Yeah, right.
Interesting term.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
You know, where you got 10,000 people asking the same guy all the same questions. I mean, you know, I mean, you know, it can drive them a little nuts, too, and I don't blame them in some cases. Because, you know, many of these athletes are not geniuses. I mean, you know, and they're short-tempered, and they're self-centered, and, you know, they don't ever want to answer a negative question in many cases. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, too, is you have to live with these guys. If I'm, like, when I was covering the Blackhawks, I'm with them every game, home and road. You know, I got to depend on these guys to tell me stories, too. So if I write a lot of stuff they don't like, I mean, that's what separates a professional from an amateur is, can you be negative about your favorite team? Can you be negative about your favorite athlete when it deserves to be so? And if you can't, then you shouldn't be in the business.
So let's talk a little bit about that. And you're with the Hawks, and I'm thinking of Bulls or whatever beat reporter you are.
Mm-hmm.
If you say too many unflattering things in your articles, does that become problematic in the future? And we're talking about problems for a journalist now, too. Does that become a real issue that now you can't get accessibility, you can't get the story that you wanted?
He may shut you out. Yeah, I
mean, that's what I'm saying.
There's plenty of examples of where reporters won't talk to certain, or I mean where athletes or the sources won't talk to certain reporters in some cases. Here's the thing.
This is a tough...
when you're a beat guy, you live with these guys. I mean, can you imagine now, like, say, for instance, I write something really negative about Bob Pulford. Right? And see, when I covered the Blackhawks, they were terrible. It was in the 80s.
Right, right.
But you know, you write something negative about he made a stupid line change or something, which needs to be told because it was a key to the game. Then the next day, you're at practice, and you got to go interview him, and he's read your story. I mean, day in and day out, day in and day out, day in and day out. That's what you have to be prepared to do. You know, if you're going to be an objective professional reporter, you have to be able to face the music the next day. You can't run from them.
And that's tough, too.
Oh, very tough.
Because you don't want to lose the accessibility.
I mean, I've had Bobby Knight scream at me. I've had his wife scream at me. I've had, you know, all kinds of stuff. So.
Well, that's kind of a status thing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I've been sued the whole bit. I love it.
We'll come back to that. I tell you, there's so much to talk about in journalism. We are talking to Mike Conklin and his 35 years at the Chicago Tribune, among other things. More after this. Don't go away. And that's music from the Eagles, Don Henley, lead singer. Dirty Laundry, he's talking about journalism, and we're also talking to Mike Conklin about his career as a writer, and you cover the Chicago Bears. We were talking about that in the last segment, and I was going to ask you, who are some of the more interesting people you've met in your career?
Well, I mean, you know, I've had a whole
ton of them,
flood of them, you know, I mean, from Willie Mays to Will Chamberlain to Bob Dole, you know,
wow.
but I mean, and I would collect stories. And one of the things I think people sometimes make a mistake about is they get a quick impression of somebody and they think that's the way they are, you know, and because, oh, he signed my kid's autograph. He must be a great guy. Well, he might go home and beat his wife for all you know. I mean, seriously, I mean, you know,
right.
People don't understand. They don't understand that part, but because there's professional, there's public and private, you know, of athletes or anybody. And I used to collect stories of people and people would call me with things when I was writing a sports column, and which was a daily, 5 days a week thing, like ink, basically. And one of the guys I started to accumulate some good stuff about was Jim Harbaugh. I love Jim Harbaugh. And when I would cover the Bears, he was always so gracious with everybody after the game. Now, a lot of people don't like him as a coach now, but, you know, I mean, he's supposed to be a little bit objectionable to deal with now as a head coach. I could care less. All I care about is my relationship with him. And He was really a good guy. He diagrammed plays for me after the game.
Wow.
He'd show stuff. You know, this is what we were trying to
no
do.
No kidding.
Yeah, I mean, he was a coach. His dad was a coach, so I mean, he was a coach. And his philosophy,
so when he was a player, it's like he was talking like a coach.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And his whole philosophy of life was simple. He said, "I play as long as I can. I'm going to coach as long as I can, and then I'm going to die." He said, "That's all I want to do is play and then coach."
Hmm.
But anyway, when he was a coach with the Bears, I'll never forget this. The Bears,
you mean a QB with
yeah,
the Bears?
When he's quarterbacking the Bears. He used to, the athletes on Monday night when the Bears weren't playing, and this was when they were hot, they would go out into the bars on Monday night and they would do commentary on the Monday night games and they get paid a couple grand or so. And, you know, to like a sports bar would have, you know, Otis Wilson come out or something and
say
a few words, sign some autographs and go home on a Monday night football. And there was a place called O'Reilly's Daughter down in Oak Lawn, which is this really famous sports bar on the south side and Midway Airport area. And there was a guy that ran it. And when anybody would come in there, he would always call me, you know, and tell me if somebody on those Monday nights. And he was really a good guy to tell me good stuff that was going on there, you know. He called me up on a Tuesday and said, "Well, we had Harbaugh out here last night." And I said, "Oh, that's great." He said, "Did he do anything? Did he choke on a bone or, you know, whatever?"
Sure, sure.
And he
right.
said, "You're not going to believe this." He said, "I hope you're sitting down." He said, "But he stays to the game." He said, "He stays to the end of the game, first of all." Most of these guys bug out at halftime after they sign a few autographs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he's here till like midnight, and he's signing autograph after autograph after autograph. There's a big line of people. And he says, at the end of it, there's this little old guy with a football comes up, you know, kind of, you know, an older guy. And Jim's signing the football for him. And he says, the guy says to him, "Well, would you sign it to my son?" And I says, "Yeah, sure." He said, "What's his name?" And he gets his name, Jimmy or whatever. And he said, "So it's kind of late for him to be here, right?" Jim says to the dad. And the dad says, "Well, no, it's not quite that simple." He said, "He's in the hospital." "Oh," Jim says, "that's terrible. What's wrong?" He says, "Well, he's got cancer. We don't think he's going to make it, you know. And this would mean a lot to him." And Jim says, "Oh, God, that's terrible." Now, keep in mind, it's about 12:30 in the morning. And Jim says, "Well, where is he? What hospital?" He says, "Well, he's at the hospital down the street here, a couple miles away, down on 95th Street or whatever." And Jim says, "How about if we deliver this football to him?" He said, "You go get in your car. I'll follow you to the hospital, and I'll go deliver this to him personally." And so Jim gets in his car, follows the guy. He comes into the hospital. They go up to the kid's room. Here's Jim Harbaugh at 1 o'clock in the morning, you know, on his own time. You know, well, not his own time, but, you know, they all have their own time. But, you know, and he sits there for like about an hour talking to the kid in the middle of the night, you know.
That's a wonderful story, Mike.
And the hospital, yeah. The people, when he comes walking in, they're going, "No, we got Jim Harbaugh here.
Yeah.
What do you want?" "Well, I want to go see Jimmy, you know." And so they take him up there, you know. So, you know, a couple of weeks later, the kid died. I followed up on it to, you know, do. But I'll never forget that story, you know. And I'm not saying every athlete's got that in him. In fact, very few do, unfortunately. But not very few, but not a lot do. You know, I can never look at him and not see a good guy, you know, somebody that would do something.
Boy,
like
I tell you, Mike, lots of stories.
Yeah.
Fascinating career as a journalist. I wish we had more time. We are plumb out of time, and I have about 35 more questions for you. Anyway, thank you so much for coming.
No problem.
Tremendous. Just a lot of fun. Thanks so much again for listening, and thank you for tuning in. I hope you'll drop by again next Thursday at 11 o'clock a.m. when we talk to another captivating guest on Word of Mouth.